Let me describe the types of problems that we normally have on exams, and let me give you a warning for the new people that there are no multiple choice exams in this course. Everything is short answer, something written out, which I think most people eventually prefer because it does give you the chance to have partial credit. So now if you're used to multiple guess exams, then it might be a little bit of a rough transition, but that's partly why we're going over this today. So the four main types of problems that they had last quarter were theoretical questions where you would have to write out a bit more of an explanation. So for example, hyperconjugation was a topic for last quarter. There were a couple different questions where they had to write out pictorial diagrams showing orbitals and then discussing hyperconjugation and linking that to why, for example, certain carbocations are more likely to be formed. Second type of problem, very simplistic, nomenclature. So you do need to be able to take simple molecules. We didn't do every single rule on the planet, but you need to be able to take simple molecules and name those or potentially take a name and then draw a structure for that molecule. Third type of problem, very important for this course, mechanism. This is a mechanism-based course. It's not just a memorization style OCHEM. It's not just pre-med OCHEM. So mechanism figures heavily into every reaction that we learn. And so there's some questions where all you are asked to do is to write out the mechanism for a reaction. And then there's what I call the fill-in-the-blank problems, where you'd have a substrate, something that's going to be reacted upon, the set of reagents, and then the product that's generated. Except one of those three things is left out, and you have to be able to come up with either the substrate, the reagents, or the product. A new type of problem that will be heavily used this quarter is the multi-step synthesis problem, where you start out with some kind of original compound, you're shown the target molecule, and you're told that target can only be made from that original compound as the source of carbon. So we haven't started doing those yet. We've seen just a couple of examples in class last quarter. That's probably the area where coming from the outside, you might be ahead of us. We had a very heavy theoretical quarter last quarter, and now we're going to shift very heavily into synthesis this quarter. So in fact, I want to start with the fill-in-the-blank type of problem first, because that's probably for the returning people what they're most curious the right answers were. Then I'd like to step backwards, do a mechanism problem, and then do a short theory type problem. And that, unfortunately, is all the time that we'll have today. But for everybody that was here last quarter, we'll go over some of the other answers over the next couple of lab or lecture days. So for those of you who do have the final, if you turn to the last page, the fill-in-the-blank problems. First one, you had a missing substrate that reacted with mercury acetate and methanol, followed by sodium borohydride and sodium hydroxide to form an ether. So just a refresher. Oh dear, that's blurry, isn't it? Hold on. Better? Just a reminder about the way to write reagents. So you notice there is a 1 and a 2 used in this problem. And so that explicitly means that everything that's listed after the 1, those reagents react first and separately from everything that's listed under 2. Sometimes in real life, you can directly add the second set of reagents to a reaction flask. Sometimes you have to isolate the intermediate first. Those kinds of details are often left out when you're just trying to write a synthesis down like this. But still, it's important that you have the 1 and the 2 here for this particular reaction. There are some reactions, though, where would it be inappropriate to use a 1 and a 2. For example, simple hydrogenation. You need both hydrogen gas and the catalyst present at the same time. If you put 1 platinum, 2 hydrogen, that would show that they're supposed to be kept separate from each other and the reaction wouldn't work then. So you have to use 1s and 2s where you're supposed to, but you must leave out the 1s and 2s where it's appropriate as well. So what kind of conditions are these? What type of reaction does this set of reagents match? Duh. Well, you need an alkene to react with it, yes. So an alkene is going to be what goes in the box there. But do you remember the name of this type of reaction? Oxymercuration demercuration. Except this is a slight variation on that reaction because there's methanol there instead of water. That's why we end up with an ether as a product, because if you remember, plain old oxymercuration demercuration generates an alcohol. But by substituting the methanol there, that's how we now have that ether. This is a Markovnikov addition, which means what? That the nucleophile portion that's adding to the double bond ends up at the most substituted position. Another way of saying it is the electrophile, which in this case is going to be mercury, is going to end up at the least substituted position. So we need an alkene, and we need an alkene where the most substituted carbon is the one where the ether group is going to show up. And that means there's only one correct answer. That you end up with a terminal alkene. Why? Well, because if you had an alkene between this tertiary carbon and then the secondary carbon, the tertiary carbon would be the more substituted one, so the ether is going to end up at that point instead. This is not a carbocation-based reaction. It is cationic, but it's not carbocationic, because you end up with that unusual cyclic mercury intermediate. And because of that, there's no rearrangement. And that's why it's fine that we have this terminal alkene, because the ether really is going to end up at that most substituted point. Questions? Now, I'm just going to keep moving from question to question, but if you've got a question, please stop me. And then for the new people in particular, if you have questions, don't be afraid to stop me. Or if you're just completely unfamiliar with the reaction, make a note of it. And like I said, I'll be making that list of reactions to help you all out. Yes?
Which subject did you leave off from class?
We covered alkyl halides, so making them by doing free radical halogenation. We did alkenes, and we did a fair number of reactions. This was one of them, hydroboration oxidation, reduction using hydrogen. We also covered alkynes. But we stopped at alkynes. So we'd seen some methods for making alcohols, but have not done reactions of alcohols. We've had nomenclature of alcohols, but we're going to be reviewing that today and picking up with alcohols and ethers this quarter. We also heavily covered, I should say, alkyl halides in the sense of their reactivity with SN1, SN2, E1, and E2 reactions. All right. Next one of these problems. You're given the substrate, but not the reagent. And you form this difunctional molecule. Does anybody remember what the name of this type of functional group is? Well, it's got part of it looking like water had added to it, but you also have a halogen. So if you can remember that, this is a halohydrin. More specifically, it's a bromohydrin because you have bromine on there. Did anyone remember the set of reagents to make a halohydrin? Bromine and what else? Water. You have to specify that water is there. If you had just bromine by itself, you would end up with a vicinal dibromide, two bromines right next door to each other. Because of water being there, water ends up being the thing that attacks. Remember that this reaction forms a cyclic intermediate as well, just like in the first reaction, the mercury one. And water is the thing that pushes that intermediate open in this case. Now, it is important that you list both the reagents simultaneously, and light should not be listed as a condition for this reaction. This is an electron pair mechanism, so no light is involved. Next one. We start off with a cyclic alkene that reacts with metachloroperoxybenzoic acid. For the new ones of you, you might have instead learned the reagent magnesium monoperoxyphthalate, which does the same job. It is the top reagent only, though, that I think that this class had learned, and I'll write the structure of that reagent out. We are, in fact, going to be covering benzene and its derivatives this quarter. This is a derivative of benzene, so benzoic acid is just sticking a carboxylic acid group on here. Peroxybenzoic acid means there's an extra oxygen in it, which is what gives this reagent its unusual reactivity. The MC part of the name, metachloro, meta is a position two positions away from the first substituent. We're going to be learning about ortho, meta, and para again this quarter. And chloro means chlorine. So that is metachloroperoxybenzoic acid, which is a reagent that creates what? Epoxide, correct. An epoxide is a three-membered ring where you have two carbons and one oxygen. It's a cyclic ether, and ethers and epoxides are one of our topics in just a few weeks from now. So, however, this is a flat alkene. The carbons are sp2 hybridized, which means that this MCPPA could attack from the top or from the bottom. And since you would end up with something that's not totally symmetric, you do end up with two products. You end up with a mixture of enantiomers. It's physically impossible for that ring to be formed where one carbon is pointing up to the oxygen, the other is pointing down. So in other words, this reaction occurs with syn addition. So the rings could either be written both with wedges or both with dashes. Now, returning students, if you do have questions about how I graded something, save your questions for today just because we're not really going to have time. Or I do have office hours today in between lab and lecture. Or more particularly, save it for Wednesday, because once we start lab on Wednesday, there's going to be plenty of time for me to be able to review your final if I made a mistake, for example. Questions before I move on? All right, next one. Unknown substrate, reacting with three equivalents of hydrogen and platinum to form an alkane. This will probably be the most frustrating one for those of you who didn't get it right once you see what the right answer is. So hydrogen and platinum, those are the conditions for hydrogenation. Three equivalents of hydrogen would mean that there are three pi bonds that react. But we got to think about how could we stuff three different pi bonds onto the structure, because if we look at the middle of the molecule there, that is a quaternary carbon, and you can't make a double bond to a quaternary position. So that means that none of these three carbons at the bottom here could have been involved in making pi bonds. Well, that leaves only the ethyl group on the left, and then the ethyl group on the right is where we could put the unsaturation. Well, if we put one double bond on either side, that leads us only to having 2 degrees of unsaturation, which means only 2 hydrogens would have been consumed. So what's the way we could get 3? Put a triple bond in. So a triple bond on one side, a double bond on the other, that would give you exactly 3 degrees of unsaturation. And so that's what the correct answer was. If you had 2 triple bonds, that's too many hydrogens that would be needed. If you only had double bonds, you weren't using enough hydrogens. Next problem. Involving hydrogenation still. This time starting with just an alkyne reacting with something to make an alkene, specifically with cis configuration. So if you hopefully remember to stop at the alkene, but to make a cis double bond, that would be still plain hydrogenation, but using a poisoned catalyst. So for this course last quarter, I did not have everyone memorize the components of it. We just went by the name, Lindler's catalyst, which is palladium or platinum that has been poisoned with lead, usually something like lead carbonate. Might be a base in there like quinoline, which quinoline is a compound we'll cover this quarter. But you're not required to know those components. Just in case you didn't know that name, that's part of the constituent of it. Reduces the reactivity of the catalyst, makes it where it can stop here. But with the catalyst, you have to have the reagent itself that's reacting. And since in this case it's D that got added, deuterium, D2 would be the other reagent. Next one is the trickiest one we had. And it is something that came up in our discussion of the reaction of alkynes. Because, for example, if you wanted to use borane with an alkyne, in principle, if we ignored any other considerations, it could try to generate something like this, where an OH group ends up at the same position as an alkene. But what's the name that we often use for this kind of compound, where there's an alcohol and an alkene joined at the same carbon? An enol, that's right, which you can remember because it's an alkene, and alkenes are named with the functional group ending ene, and an alcohol, which are named with the functional group ending ol. So an enol is almost always thermodynamically unstable. We're going to learn one major exception later in the quarter. But a plain, non-cyclic, particularly, enol is usually not favorable. So this undergoes a type of reaction known as tautomerization. Which we'll cover a little bit again this quarter, and it'll come up a fair bit next quarter again. Tautomerization looks a little bit like resonance, but it's not resonance because it is two separate molecules, what you start with and what you end up with. And so what it involves is the exchange of a single and a double bond. So the carbon-carbon double bond turns into a single bond, the carbon-oxygen single bond turns into a double bond. And so in other words, what we end up with, is a ketone. The last question was something the class had been warned they would need to know. The one multi-step synthesis we did see last quarter. So two separate reagents that were used to convert an alkene into an alkyne. Well, this was the two-step process of using bromine and then a strong base, Br2, adds to the double bond, again putting a bromine at neighboring positions. And if you use a strong base like sodium amide, it can do a double elimination reaction. So technically, it would be best to say bromine like this, and then two equivalents of sodium amide. If you didn't put the two equivalents in, I don't think I bothered commenting on that, but just technically it should be two equivalents because two eliminations do occur. Any questions on any of the fill-in-the-blank problems? So let's back up one problem then to the mechanism problems. I'll start with the first set of mechanisms. So first was a terminal alkyne reacting first with sodium amide, followed by iodomethane or methyl iodide, followed by sodium metal in liquid ammonia. So the first reaction is connected to the fact that alkynes are, for plain hydrocarbons, somewhat unusually acidic. And there were three factors that we discussed last quarter as to why a compound might be more acidic. One of them was, what is the case here, hybridization, which I'll return to that in just a second. Second was an inductive effect. If you had some kind of electronegative element, it could pull electron density towards itself, making it easier for a bond that had been connected to it easier to break. And then there's resonance. Acetic acid, for example, is as acidic as it is because once the hydrogen comes off, the resulting anion is stabilized by resonance. Now back to the case of hybridization. If this hydrogen on the terminal alkyne was removed, you'd end up with a lone pair on a carbon that's sp hybridized, versus if we had an alkene, which would be sp2 hybridized, or an alkane that would be sp3 hybridized. For polyelectronic systems, sp hybrid orbitals are lower in energy than sp2 than sp3. And so putting a lone pair into that lower energy orbital means it's easier for the hydrogen of an alkyne to come off than it would be for the less energetically favorable alkene than it would be for an alkane. So that's why alkynes have a pKa of about 25 versus alkenes about 34 versus alkanes that can be up in the 50s and 60s. So first step here is just an acid-base neutralization. Now, for returning students and newbies alike, I'm fussy about lone pairs. So if you're used to a textbook that doesn't show lone pairs, or you have an instructor that didn't care, you've got to have a little transition, because I count, because I want to know that you know what the proper oxidation states for all these atoms is. Once we've deprotonated, we formed an intermediate known as the acetylide ion, which is a type of ion that we're going to encounter again, both when we play around with epoxides and also when we get to a really important reaction this quarter called the Grignard reaction. Second step here is an SN2 reaction. So acetylide ions can be used for SN2 as long as you're using primary substrates, or even better, something like this, a methyl substrate where there's zero chance of elimination occurring. So very easy SN2 reaction would occur. Methyl iodide is very reactive. We end up with now an internal alkyne, which now reacts with sodium metal and ammonia liquid, which hopefully you remember that are, that's the set of conditions for reduction to form a trans alkene. Now, last quarter there were two reactions that involved radicals. This was one of them, this radical reduction. The other one was free radical halogenation. I'm pointing that out because this is one of the few places that we would use single arrows. Everything else, all these other arrows so far have been double-headed arrows, meaning that they show the flow of two electrons at a time. But because this is a radical process, some of the arrows here are going to be single-headed arrows. So in fact, it starts off with a single electron transfer of an electron. Where does that electron come from? Well, sodium, because sodium's a good reducing agent because it has a low ionization energy. So the electrons are just floating around solution. Why does this cause this bond to break? Well, if we think back to molecular orbital theory, this triple bond is composed of a sigma bond and two pi bonds. Well, if we have bonds, there are antibonding orbitals as well. And so this electron ends up going into an antibonding orbital. We will, by the way, be covering Molecular orbital theory again this quarter, when we get to conjugated systems and when we get to benzene, which means, oh yes, we have more SMOG diagrams that you're going to have to draw. So, back to this one though, electron adds in, that does cause one of the pi bonds to break, and we end up with an intermediate known as a radical anion, which since both positions eventually end up reacting, it doesn't matter which one we draw the radical or the lone pair on, but the point is you end up with both. Now we've gone from an alkyne to an alkene. That alkene having a lone pair, much more basic than the alkyne was. And in fact, basic enough to do something unusual, which is to force ammonia, which is normally a base, to instead act as an acid, a source of hydrogen. Since that is an acid-base neutralization, we're back to using the double-headed arrows, the electron pair process. That gets us to a radical, which will react with another electron. So two reductions end up happening. Now, this is the key point of this reaction mechanism, because that radical, that position where the radical was, had been sp hybridized. You might recall that single electrons don't have the repulsive force that electron pairs do. And because of that, they don't affect geometry. So in terms of Vesper theory, we would still call that position linear, because there's only one atom on either side the carbon's bound to. Hybridization is a framework that is its purpose is to try to match the predictions of Vesper. So since a single electron doesn't affect geometry, it also doesn't affect hybridization. So that's still sp hybridized. Until it does get that extra electron, which means it now turns into a lone pair, which means it's sp2 hybridized, which means it matters which way we put the lone pair. Well, thermodynamically, the methyl group wants to be pointed away from the first one to avoid steric interaction, and so the lone pair is going to end up in the position where I've written it. Of course, since this is still in ammonia, that means one more neutralization can occur. And so the product of this first reaction is trans-butene. Questions on that mechanism? Yes? Okay, so this one is sp hybridized, and then this one has become sp2. Because the lone pair does count. But the single electron does not. Let's do the second mechanism, considerably easier than the first one. So here we have an alkene reacting first with HBr, followed by sodium methoxide. So HBr, those are the conditions for plain old simple electrophilic addition. Alkene first attacks the H plus from HBr, and then the counterion turns back and attacks the carbocation that forms. So here's the attack on hydrogen. This occurs with Markovnikov addition, which means that hydrogen ends up at the less substituted position, so that the carbocation ends up at the most stable, the tertiary position of this molecule. Bromine now can come back to attack. Which forms only one product. Realize that since the ring is symmetric, there is not a stereocenter formed here. Now, I don't think I took off points if you showed two different products. Just realize, even though you might use wedges and dashes, it didn't matter in this case because there's no stereo center. But I am going to use wedges and dashes to show this, because if I'm being really careful, I need to show the stereochemistry of the next step. Which, if you didn't do it, you weren't marked off, but I'm doing this for review purposes. Because consider this, what kind of alkyl halide did I just synthesize? In terms of its substitutiveness, is it a primary, secondary, or tertiary alkyl halide? Tertiary. Why? Because there's three carbons connected to the carbon that the bromine's connected to. Tertiary alkyl halide. What kind of nucleophilic reactions can a tertiary undergo? SN1, SN2, E1, or E2, or some combination of those. So SN1, because it's good at forming a carbocation. If SN1's possible, what automatically else is possible? E1. What else can a tertiary substrate do? E2, that's right. Why can't it do SN2? Too hindered, too much steric hindrance. All right, now what kind of nucleophile are we throwing at it? Is it ionic or non-ionic? Ionic, meaning we're going to have an oxygen negatively charged. So is this a strong or a weak nucleophile? Is it a basic or non-basic nucleophile? Basic. So we have a strong basic nucleophile and a tertiary substrate. What reaction does that automatically mean is going to happen? E2. Now, if it's E2, we have to wonder if it's going to be Zaitsev elimination or Hoffman elimination. Zaitsev meaning the most thermodynamically stable, most substituted alkenal form. Hoffman, I don't know if we use that term or not. We might have just called it anti-Zaitsev, but that's when a less thermodynamically stable alkene forms. Why would a less favored alkene form? What would we normally have to use to force that to happen? Use a hindered base, use a hindered nucleophile. But is this a big, bulky nucleophile? Not particularly. And so this should go by standard Zaitsev elimination, meaning that if it's choosing to pull a hydrogen off the ring versus that methyl group, it's going to pull it off the ring. Since it is a cyclohexane ring, what does that mean about the relative position of the hydrogen being removed and the leaving group, the bromine? They have to be trans from each other because that's the only way you could get both of them into an axial position, which is what would give us the anti-periplanar geometry necessary for an E2 reaction. So if I was being really, really technical, that would mean for this particular structure, I have to show the hydrogen with a dash being pulled off, not a wedge. Now, because this is not a stereocenter, because there are two hydrogens there, you could have shown everything with just plain lines. And again, that would have been fine. But this is reminding us of that anti-periplanar geometry that a cyclic elimination must have. So methoxide pulls the hydrogen off simultaneously because it's an E2 reaction. The pair of electrons falls back and kicks bromine off. And the one and only product we end up with is 1-methylcyclohexene. Which here you should not have used wedges and dashes at all because that part of the molecule is flat. Yes? other questions on this mechanism? Yes. Because what happens is those sigma bonds kind of transform into a pi bond. And if you have the bonds parallel like this, or parallel like this, so one side or the other, then it more easily forms the pi bond. And so if you have periplanar geometry, that's where the groups are pointed like that, and that's also possible, just not in this case. What's possible in this case is anti-periplanar. All right, now let's do the third mechanism, which was its own separate problem because this one was the toughest in terms of memory work. We had gotten to alkenes just at the end of the quarter, and this was a full reaction involving, an alkyne. You had some warning this was going to be on the final or something like this because at the time of the third exam, we did not have borane as a mechanism on that exam. And so you were strongly hinted that you were going to see borane in a mechanism on your final, which you did. And although the reagent itself looks scary, it actually makes the mechanism quicker to write because, well, let's see why. So you had terminal alkyne again that reacted with this substituted borane. So for the new people, if you're not familiar with this reagent, this does the same thing as BH3. So if you look at it, it's just been modified to have two alkyl groups on it instead. And there is a shorthand way to write that compound. Make what looks like the letter pi. Really, it's the same kind of alkyl group, just drawn more stylistically, in a little more compact way. So you might have seen that version before. But the alkyl groups do two things. One, it makes it where the boron only has one reactable hydrogen, which if we're reacting with an alkyne, one potential issue with doing hydroboration of alkynes is the formation of a network product. And that's because borane normally has three reactable hydrogens, which means if it reacted with one alkyne, then it has two more hydrogens that can continue reacting. Well, this helps prevent that, along with the fact that these alkyl groups are bulky, and so just on the basis of sterics, it helps prevent any further reaction. Because even once you add to an alkyne, there's still another pi bond there that could react. So short story, this makes addition happen only once. You still have the same workup conditions that you'd have for any kind of hydroboration, which is hydrogen peroxide and sodium hydroxide. So remember that in borane, boron is the less electronegative atom. That's why it has the appearance of doing a backwards reaction, because the hydrogen, which normally goes to the least substituted position, instead goes to the most substituted position. So I'm going to lay it out like this. And this is what I meant by the use of R notation. I know several of you asked for clarification during the final what I meant, but that was part of the question. Did you know what R meant? Which is just a variable name, and it makes it where you don't have to write that 1,2-dimethylpropyl group over and over and over and over and over again. And in fact, this is probably one of the most common errors that some of you made, that you were able to answer the problem, but then you got sidetracked. Because it really didn't matter what happened to the R group in this reaction. That R group is just there to be something sterically bulky on the borane. You needed to focus instead just what happened on the alkyne, which is what I'm going to show you now. First step of the reaction, simultaneous attack of the pi bond on boron, and then a hydride attacking back to the pi bond. This forms a four-centered transition state, which is part of the reason why this is a syn addition, S-Y-N. Since it's syn addition, we're going to end up with the new hydrogen and the boron on the same face of the alkene. There are no more hydrogens, so that boron doesn't react further. The boron, the substituents are bulky enough that the alkene doesn't react further. And so the next step is to do the hydrogen peroxide and hydroxide oxidation. In solution, hydrogen peroxide is, well, maybe even out of solution. Hydrogen peroxide is more acidic than water, so hydroxide will deprotonate hydrogen peroxide to make the hydrogen peroxide ion, which then will attack boron because boron lacks an octet. That's what gives boron a lot of its unusual reactivity, including the next step of this reaction. Because notice that with the addition of the hydrogen peroxide, boron has now become negatively charged. And notice the sequence of bonds that we have here. From the alkene, we have a carbon connected to boron, connected to oxygen, connected to oxygen. Well, that oxygen-oxygen peroxide bond is weak. And a carbon-boron bond is not anywhere near as favorable as an oxygen-boron bond. So what happens is that group will shift over. Now, yes, in theory, the R groups could do this as well, but again, those weren't the focus of the reaction. You need to show what the alkyne, or now that's turned into alkene, is doing. So that shift is very unusual because hydroxide, in a sense, becomes a leaving group. It's not an SN1 or SN2 reaction, but kind of robbing that terminology, that's what looks like that's going on here. And what we now have is an oxygen between what used to be the alkyne and the boron. If we are only focusing on that alkyne, then what happens next is this decomposes. Again, ignoring what happens to the R groups, hydroxide can now attack the boron. Which again makes boron negatively charged. And that negative charge could be relieved by hydroxide just popping right back off, or it could be this product that pops off, which if it did, there would be a rapid neutralization that occurs. And for most hydroboration reactions, this would be the end. But we just made an enol. And I'd mentioned earlier how enols are not thermodynamically stable. And so this can't be isolated. It's going to turn right back around and react again. Hydroxide can again pull the hydrogen off. Technically, one could argue that maybe the hydrogen never hopped on in the first place. A subtlety that we don't really need to worry about at this point. But I am pointing out, yeah, we could have just, instead of this alkoxide getting protonated, what I'm about to show you, we could have shown here. So if you did take that shortcut, that was perfectly acceptable. Because the point is, when we have that negative charge on the oxygen, it's a delocalized system. We could show the negative charge instead being on carbon. Which could then get protonated. Now realize, this whole process has been taking place in basic conditions. So at the very end here, you can't suddenly switch and say H plus as a way of putting a hydrogen on there. You have to show water, which we can assume water's there because we had hydroxide pulling off a hydrogen somewhere else earlier, right there. So the final product in this case is an aldehyde. Questions on that last mechanism? So I'm running a little bit low on time. We won't need to rush this next part, but we do only have time for one more question. And I'd like to do the question right before the mechanism, because this is a somewhat theory-based problem. This was a problem where in which they were presented a series of pairs of reactions, comparison between different types of SN1 and SN2 reactions. The question was being asked, which of the pair of these reactions would be the faster reaction and why? So let's see the first pair, because in that first pair, it was the same substrate reacting with the same nucleophile both times. So bromoethane reacting with sodium fluoride to make fluoroethane. Again, same reaction twice. But in the first case, methanol was used as a solvent. So this ME abbreviation, I don't use it a lot my own self, but the textbook sometimes does, or a lot of texts do. So ME for methyl, ET for ethyl, PR for propyl, BU for butyl. The other reaction, I didn't write out the abbreviation. I instead wrote out the structure, which might have thrown some of you off. But this is the solvent DMF, NN dimethyl formamide, which is a great polar aprotic solvent. And that was the point of the question. Methanol is a protic solvent. So yes, protic versus aprotic will change the order of the reactivity of halogens, but also slows all of the halogens down to being a protic solvent. And so methanol being protic will slow the reaction down versus DMF, which would encourage the reaction because it's not going to interfere with the nucleophile. Yes, the clock is an hour past, but I'm still running out of time because we're really supposed to have taken a break by now. But yes, if you all are eagerly awaiting the end of class, you've got yet one more hour on top of what that's showing. Questions about this first pair? So it's going to be the second of these that is the faster reaction. Again, because it's an aprotic solvent. Second pair, we had two different substrates that were being used with the same nucleophile. So fluoroethane reacting with sodium hydroxide to make ethanol versus bromoethane reacting with sodium hydroxide to make ethanol. I would like to direct your attention to the directions for that question, because it very clearly says, be sure to explain the underlying reason for the greater reaction rate. An answer in the form of the molecule has a better whatever is inadequate. And so if you looked at this and said, oh, well, bromine's the better leaving group, the direction says that's not a good enough answer. Why is it the better leaving group? And it's because it is the conjugate base of a stronger acid. HBr is a strong acid, which makes bromine a good nucleophile. HF is a weak acid, which is, did I just say nucleophile? Good leaving group. HF is a weak acid, which means its conjugate fluoride is basic, which is why it's a poor leaving group. So it is the second reaction that is faster. And that's because Br is the conjugate of a stronger acid. HBR versus HF. Next pair, we have the same reagent, two different substrates again. So one was bromoethane reacting with this sulfur nucleophile. And then the other was 2-bromo-2-methylpropane reacting with that same nucleophile, in both cases forming, wow, I didn't know it was that good, both forming thiols. So what kind of nucleophile is this, strong or weak? It's quite a strong nucleophile because it is charged, it's ionic, and it has sulfur, which remember that sulfur being squishier, being more polarizable than oxygen, more easily forms bonds in substitution reactions. So it's not as basic as hydroxide, but it's much more nucleophilic. If this is a strong nucleophile, what kind of reaction is it going to favor? SN2. And SN2 would be more favorable with that first primary substrate or that second tertiary substrate. Why the primary? Less steric hindrance. So the first reaction is faster. It's SN2, and there's less steric hindrance. Last pair, similar situation. A primary substrate reacting with water to form ethanol, and a tertiary substrate reacting with water to form t-butanol. Water, is that a strong or a weak nucleophile? Weak, non-charged. So weak nucleophiles, do they favor SN1 or SN2? SN1. Primary versus tertiary substrate, which is better for SN1? Tertiary, incredibly better. Because it's nearly impossible to favorably generate a carbocation on a primary carbon. A carbocation is the main intermediate in an SN1 reaction. And so that's why this tertiary substrate works so much better. So SN1 and a tertiary carbocation is a much more favorable intermediate. All right, at this point, I'd like to take a 5-minute break. Normally, structure-wise, timing-wise, we're supposed to have lab lecture from 7:30 to 8:20. And then even though it's not listed in the schedule, we are supposed to then give a short break. So this will be just a 5-minute break. Don't go running off to Coffee Society. We'll do the highly condensed safety lecture because most of you have heard this safety lecture four, five, six times now, maybe even all from me. But there are a few things I do need to review. We'll briefly go over pre-lab procedure as a reminder for everybody, but particularly for the new people that haven't been with us before. Then we'll do check-in, and then we'll be done with lab. And then, again, office hours will be at 10:30, and then the lecture will be at 11:30 right after that. Main safety considerations, we were getting to exits. So we have the two doors here that are labeled exit. Those are the absolute best ways out of the classroom. The one over to my left here, if you go out there, you could go right around the corner to the right here, and there's a staircase that goes down to the back side of the building. There is this door over here, but that goes to the big ugly staircase, which is probably where everybody else is going to be going in a panic. And so again, I'd probably recommend the door on my right over here, your left. The two wooden doors, these are not exits. This one goes into the balance room. That one goes into the instrument room. There are ways out of those rooms, but they're not to the exterior. So absolutely not the best way to go in emergency, partly because you can't even open those doors without my key dongle. You could, in theory, go out the front door here, the main door to the classroom, because once you go out into that hallway, if you kept on going, there is another door in the back of the building that you could exit through. But again, not ideal. So again, these two doors with this one on your left, my right, being the most preferable of them. We do have 6 eyewash stations in the classroom. So there's the 2 in the back benches up there. There's the 2 at the front benches. We have 1 in the back of the classroom, 1 here up at the front. You'll notice in the back and the front, we also have safety showers, which is a reminder me to recommend to you to bring an extra set of clothes for lab, just in case you had something occur where you spilled something all over yourself and you really did need to change. This is also for later in the year when we get back to warmer climate. Many of you prefer to wear shorts, and you are not allowed to wear shorts in the lab, and so what often people do is bring sweatpants, track pants, or something like that to change into just for lab. Since I've mentioned clothing, let me just go ahead and say you do have to have closed-toed shoes, so no sandals, not even Crocs or things that have holes in them, because you don't want chemicals falling into the shoe, so it has to be something that's closed on top. Have to have pants, sweats, skirts, dress, whatever that goes down to the ankle, so full length. And we recommend a lab coat, but don't require one. And there's no particular restriction on tops, except that the less that you have exposed, the safer that you are. Aside from clothing, you do have to have goggles, which how many of you remember to bring your goggles to check in today? Because it isn't just chemicals that you're worried about or should be worried about, it's bits of glassware flying around as well. So if you didn't bring your goggles today, we do have a set of goggles that you can use until you get your own. These we just check out here locally at the classroom. I'll talk about other check-in related things in just a little bit. Back to safety. We were talking about the eyewash and the showers. There is a small first aid kit that's available in the stockroom. So if you have small cuts or burns or things like that, you might be able to just be treated here. There is a health center on campus if you are somewhat more injured, or there is the phone there which you can dial 911 without having to get to an outside line. So if we had a real emergency, we could just dial out there. There are fire alarm poles, one at the main exit door behind you there, one to your left over here. There is a fire extinguisher that's located at the door that goes to the instrument room. You'll notice in front of you, all the sinks say no disposal, no dumping of chemicals in the sink allowed. There will be bottles that are set up for chemical waste, and on an experiment-by-experiment basis, I'll explain which chemicals get disposed of in which waste buckets. So the waste for organic waste will be back in fume hood H5. You notice that each of the fume hoods is numbered. So H5 is where chemical disposal will occur. The chemicals that you'll need for your experiment, they'll usually be provided in H13. So just so I don't forget to do this later, as you all are checking in, you need to go ahead and pair up and figure out which fume hood you would like to be at. Most of the experiments we do on an individual basis, but I prefer that we not move from fume hood to fume hood during the quarter. So if you already know there's someone else you want to be a lab partner with, you can. And if you just would, try to figure out your positions as we're doing the check-in today. Back to safety, though, a little bit. Even though it says nothing goes down the sinks, there is one exception to that, which is when you're cleaning out glassware. The first time you wash out a piece of glassware, that first wash does need to go into the chemical waste. But if after you do that first wash, there doesn't appear to be any contamination on your glassware, then each subsequent wash can just go down in the sink. Now, there's a new system that we're going to have this quarter for cleaning glassware. This contraption is an acetone bath bucket. So essentially what happens is you fill up the container here with acetone, and then you put your glassware in this slotted basket. Push the basket into the acetone is going to fill up all your glassware, and you just let it sit there and soak for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, half an hour, however long it takes to get some of that recalcitrant stuff out of your glassware. Then carefully lift the basket out, the acetone drains out and leaves your glassware, which you can then retrieve. So you have to time this. This is not the 5 minutes before class ends and I'm yelling at you to get out of classroom type of thing to use. This is at the beginning of the class period. If you have dirty things from the previous period, dump them in here. Of course, you do need to be a little careful, or we might have to figure out some system of listing what's in here, since ink would just wear off, and you do need to be able to have a way of getting your glassware back. But it is going to save acetone and potentially be a better way to clean out glassware in the long run. So just want to mention that. We don't have this set up yet, obviously. And in fact, we don't have any waste bottles out yet today. So if and when later on you're checking into your lab equipment, you could just retain any items that are dirty for now. I just didn't want to forget to mention this, because somehow yesterday we ended up with this terrible, nasty smell in the stock room. And what they're wondering is if maybe something from one of the lockers here got returned because it was dirty. Either the person didn't realize it was dirty or knew it was and wanted something clean. We totally don't know what had happened, but it's something organic and something that's nasty smelling. So when you're checking things in and out today, if you've got something dirty, don't go give it to the stock room. If we needed to, we could go figure out who was checked in last quarter and go yell at them. But keep the item for now, and then on Wednesday when we, or no, you're Tuesday, Thursday. On Thursday when we start lab, then we can handle cleaning out any old glassware. So let's see, talked about the exits, phone, eyewash station, clothing. Oh, the few of you who have brought in water bottles this morning, please realize that even though we are doing lecture in here, this is a lab space, so there's no food or drink in the lab. So now, from now on, wow, I don't think I even caught you all sneaking your coffee in this morning. That's because I left right when I left you in the classroom, wasn't it? So what people have been doing, if they've been leaving it outside the classroom here, which to my knowledge there hasn't been a problem with that, it's kind of like the group mentality. If each of you had something that would get lost if someone else took it, then no one takes it, so everybody can have their stuff safe. But if you do bring stuff into the classroom, water bottles especially, I do notice people sneaking the from now and then. So I'll just have to ask you, either put it outside or pour it out, or if it's chocolate, then I'll just take it. So no more food and drink in the lab. There are some other safety rules. The syllabus I hadn't posted yet because I'm just finishing up filling in example problems. I already have all the lecture days assigned, though, the quiz and exam schedule. I'll mention some of that when we get to the lecture today later on. But this afternoon after class, I'm going to wrap it up, post the syllabus, and when you see it online, those of you who are new particularly, if you would read over the other safety regulations that I've got in there. For today, though, let me just tell you what you're going to be doing for your pre-lab, and then we'll go right into check-in. So pre-lab assignments, they're not that horribly long in this class. I know some instructors have you answer specific questions and do all this preparatory work. The preparatory work we do is relatively short, and especially for the new people, but reminder for everybody else, let me give you some of the rationalization why I want you to do that. The prime objective is safety, because this is an organic chemistry class, and so we do use compounds that are notably more hazardous than what you would use in a Chem 1 class. And in fact, there was one compound in particular last quarter that this class might remember that had the potential to forming something called a lacrimer, except that some of you who hadn't done your pre-lab for that experiment didn't know about that potential side reaction, which is somewhat harmful. And so it was a reminder to all of us that we do need to go through this pre-lab exercise, if for nothing else than to be worried about your own safety. But if you can't be bothered with your own safety, then realize you shouldn't impact the safety of someone next to you. So you need to know the chemicals you're playing with, and that's part of the reason for doing the pre-lab. Aside from that, you don't want to be the annoying person going around saying, wait, what was step one? Is that a 50 milliliter? Is that half a milligram? Is this blue? You know, just over and over again, the pest. Because if you're a pest, that means you don't know what you're doing, which means, again, you're unsafe and you're bothering everybody. So I don't want that to happen. Efficiency, time-wise. There's some people that they're just waiting for me to stop talking because they already know the first five things they got to do to hurry up and get the lab done to get out of lab early. And if you get out of lab early, you do have lecture that you need to come back to, but otherwise you've got a nice long break in between. So if you do your pre-lab and you're really on your game, you get out of here faster. And then there is this crazy notion that maybe you're supposed to be here learning something. So if you actually knew what the experiment was that you're doing, you might get a little bit more benefit out of it. So that's the rationalization for doing pre-labs. When you get the syllabus, ignore most what it says about doing pre-labs for now. Particularly ignore the syllabus where it talks about lab reports, because almost all the lab reports from now on are going to be heavily simplified compared to what's described in the syllabus. The syllabus is written so that I can give it to any class I teach, and it's geared heavily towards the Chem 1 class because we do a lot of quantitative manipulation in that class. Since this is O-Chem, we're just doing synthesis, much simpler reports. So new people, read over the safety guidelines, skim over the pre-lab, ignore lab reports for now, and ignore lab books for the most part. Now, does anybody have their lab book from last quarter with them? There's no reason to have it today, but anyone got one? Okay. And I just want to show you, this is all that you need for a lab notebook. It does not need to be a specific lab notebook. They make such things, but just simple $2-3 composition book. Main thing, it needs to be like this, where it has no perforated pages. In other words, in theory, you'd have to ruin the book in order to pull a page out of it. So you can't use a spiral-bound book. It has to be something bound like this, but something inexpensive. And whether it's graph paper, line paper, log graph, blank paper, doesn't matter what's on the inside. Again, as long as the pages can't come out. The only things that I'll say for now as far as formatting that lab book, and more detail I'll get into as the quarter goes on, is you want to put your name and some identifier in it, because one of you all is going to lose it this quarter. Everybody loses, every class loses a lab book at least once a quarter. So I wouldn't necessarily recommend putting your phone number or email, something like that, just because of concerns of identity theft. But if you put your name, my name, and which class and which quarter you're in, then hopefully it would get its way back to the stock room if you were to lose it. Do leave a page or so blank for a table of contents. And yes, people from previous quarters, if you want to keep using the same lab book, you can. I just request that you clip or staple or somehow bind the other pages from 12A so I don't have to go hunting through those to find your 12B prelabs. As far as the format of the prelab, all you have to do is this. All the experiments have a theoretical component to them and an experimental part. In other words, there's the first part of the experiment where it describes the theory, and then it gets down to describing what the experiment is, which I should probably tell you, since you don't have the syllabus posted yet, what those page numbers are for this first experiment. And they are 537 through 542 for the theory. I should have a dry erase pen somewhere here for one moment. 537 to 542. And then the experimental procedure itself is on 543 through 547. Let me make sure that I got to the recording. So theory again, page 537 through 542. Experiment 543 through 547. We will almost always do the mini-scale procedure. So most of these experiments have two procedures listed, a mini-scale and a micro-scale. Almost always we're going to do the mini-scale. There will be times where we reduce quantities for the experiments. This is not one of them. So we're going to do this experiment as written. Now, I was commenting on this theory versus experiment part. For the pre-lab, you only have to look at the experimental part. And what I recommend is a two-column format like this. You have one larger column that you devote to describing the procedure. And what you do is just read through the procedure in the text and not word for word copy it, but put it in your own words and make like a grocery list, a to-do list, the things that you have to accomplish in lab that day. What level of detail do you need? Only enough so that you would be able to perform the experiment without having to look at your lab text. The idea behind this is that in real life, if you're a researcher, you don't necessarily have a cookbook that you can go to and just follow word for word to get what you want out of the synthesis. You can use that as a basis, and then you write out your own procedure, have that ready in your lab book, and you take that into lab to do an experiment. And in fact, that's how we're going to do this first experiment. We'll have our lab texts out during lab lecture if we need, but then when we get to doing the experiment itself, everybody's textbook must be put away. So you need enough detail so that you could do the experiment without having to refer to your text. But sometimes it may take a paragraph or two to describe something that you could just describe in a sentence. So write it however you want to, just to make sure you could do the experiment without looking at that lab text. Again, though, only follow the mini scale, not the micro scale procedure. In this two column format, the second column I leave for data, which there won't be an awful lot of, but there is one thing that you must do. Oh, and I forgot to tell section two. Gotta go make sure I do that today. If I forget to say ever again, for each synthesis experiment that you do, you need to calculate a percent yield. And so you will be writing down the masses of things that you acquire so that you could get a percent yield. So that's why you might need that data column. Or occasionally that if we have a melting point we take or some other physical observation that we make. In this class, most of our data will be in the form of spectra, which we'll handle separately anyways. But that's the recommendation. So I'll check pre-labs right when we start lab on Wednesday, since all 7, that's right, you're going to switch sections. Since all of you are here, then you hear this announcement that regardless of what happens in the real life schedule, your pre-lab for a brand new experiment is always due the day that an experiment will be listed to begin in the syllabus. So even if I'm sick and somehow we get off schedule, the listing of the experiments in the syllabus, you follow that for preparing your pre-lab. You must have your pre-lab at the first day a new experiment begins. So I don't want any of you to come back and tell me later, oh, I didn't know it was due. Of course you did, because you were all here and it looks like all awake right now. So that's your pre-lab assignment. First experiment is the oxidation of cyclododecanol, and then you've got your theory and experimental pages. Now, only the experimental part you need to write up, but for new people, don't make the mistake that many of the old people used to. I don't know if they learned their lesson last quarter or not, which is because I don't check for the theory part, a lot of people skip that when they're preparing for an experiment until about 3 days before the lab quiz comes around, and then everybody is going around cursing me, usually, or maybe themselves, that they waited that long to start studying for the lab, because there's all this theory that all of a sudden you have to absorb. And so historically, people have performed poorly compared to what they should have on the lab quizzes, because be honest, the lab quizzes are not tough, but they do require that you remember what's been going on during the quarter. So if you wait till that last moment to study, that's why people don't do well on them. The reason that that people do the pre-labs or should be doing the pre-labs is because in theory, if you show up without a pre-lab, you just get sent home for the day, which means you can't do experiment, which means you can't write up the lab report, which means you get a zero for that lab report. So, questions about pre-lab. Now, don't be too paranoid that if you don't have exactly the right thing in there for your first pre-lab that I'm going to kick you out of the class that day. No. I'll be able to tell if you read the experiment or not just by kind of glancing through it. So don't be in a panic what your pre-lab looks like. Questions before we do check-in? Yeah. The numbers for problems that I recommend that you do for the quarter. So I've got all the chapters except two of them I've read through already. So I just fill in that in. And then I made a couple of mistakes transferring the section one to twos to section three syllabus last quarter, so I just want to give one more look over, make sure I don't do that again. And so that, I'll be posting those later this afternoon. Now for check-in, and this is geared towards everyone, but again, mainly the new people that might not know what happens. You're going to be giving this sheet. I have them here. In fact, let me pass these out. It might not quite be enough, so I'll go get some more in just a moment. This has a listing of all the equipment that you're supposed to have. Today is the one day you get to replace that equipment for free if any of it's broken or missing. Now, if it's just dirty, we'll clean it later. But only replace items that are actually broken or that are not there. We'll be doing a group check-in for part of it. If you look at that check-in sheet, there's a top table and a bottom table. The bottom table's somewhat more complicated equipment, or it's equipment that people forget the names of. So we'll be doing that together. So in fact, once I'm done talking, don't everybody run to the stock room at once, please. Let's do that bottom table together first, because it gets us out of here much more quickly. It's much more efficient that way. But check all of your glassware. Look particularly at the curved glassware for something known as a star crack. A star crack can look like a little asterisk, and it happens when you have a curved piece of glass that impacts with something that's flat. Haven't seen many of those in this class, to be honest, but this is your one chance to check your glassware for free, so you want to take advantage of that. Do we have extras? Anybody not get one? Oh, good. We had enough. Check your graduated cylinders. Take the plastic bases off the graduated cylinders. We used to do this experiment in the past where we dropped little weights down in the cylinder, and if you didn't slant it to kind of soften the landing of that weight, some people in the past did break their graduated cylinders, but you might not notice it because the break occurred where that plastic base is, and you might not have realized it was broken until you filled that graduated cylinder with liquid. So check all of your glassware thoroughly. I won't be checking it now. I only check it on the way back out when you check out of lab. If you do have something that's missing or broken, the stock room is right around. Go back out the main door here, go to the right, and you'd run into the stock room otherwise. Normally there's a checkout slip that we use to get equipment that's not required today since this is check-in, but just to describe how that works, there are these little yellow pads of paper that are sitting outside the stock room. When you need an item, you go fill out your name, the date, the lock number, what it is that you need. You give the stock room that yellow slip, and then the whole thing happens in reverse when you're done. You give the piece of equipment back, they give you the yellow slip back. Make absolutely sure you get the yellow slip back, because if there are any yellow slips left sitting in your file at the end of the quarter, then they presume you still have those items and you'd be charged for them. As far as checking out, the day to check out of this class will be the last day of lab, which is Thursday, the week before finals. We don't meet for this class either in lab or lecture the week of finals week. So that last Thursday, the 11th week of class, we'll do our second lab quiz and we'll check out. If for any reason you need to drop or withdraw from the course before then, either at that time or at that last checkout day, please make sure that you come and check back out of your lockers, because otherwise you might have a hold put in your grade. You might be charged for us having to do the checkout. So just realize that if you drop from the registration system, that's separate from you checking out properly from lab. Now, your lockers, you need to have your own lock. Hopefully you had seen that course note in the schedule, and hopefully all the rest of you all remember from last quarter, but I know some of you didn't, because that's what happens to the brain over break. So if you don't have a lock to lock your locker up with today, we should have some little plastic ties that are here in the classroom, or you might be able to beg from the stockroom to get one, but make sure you do have your lock by Thursday then. The glassware is expensive and you don't want someone else breaking into your locker to get at it. Any questions about check-in? So now I don't really have an option which locker number to assign. There's a sequence that's assigned to this class, and the names I'll be doing in alphabetical order because that helps with the stockroom. Once you've checked that you've got all your items, come up and have me sign it. You'll get a pink copy to prove that you checked in. I keep the white copy to give to the stockroom, which they make your record out of for the quarter.